Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. When humans move into wild places, it's the animals that lose out. Dr. Michael Proctor is studying the effect highways and other human development have on grizzly bear populations and their genetics. And at the recent Alberta Conservation Association conference in Calgary, scientists used the poster competition to talk about their research on ecosystem decline and the impact it has on wolves, elk, sage-grouse, and other species. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Over the last few years, grizzly bears have become an environmental icon, a poignant reminder of the harm we humans can inflict on the natural world as we seek to bring every square inch of this planet under human domination. Biologist Dr. Michael Proctor has been following what remains of our grizzly population as the bears move across the western landscape, or try to, that is. Highways and human settlements hem them in, and what this does to the grizzly's gene pool is just one of the questions Michael's been exploring. Michael is now doing postdoctoral research under the supervision of Dr. Mark Boyce, who holds the Alberta Conservation Association Research Chair in Wildlife and Fisheries at the University of Alberta.
Most grizzly bear studies happen in small to medium scales, but nobody's really ever had a look at the real big picture, like get up in a really high airplane and look down over the whole landscape and see how bears are operating at a landscape and population level over a large area. So my main focus was to look at population fragmentation. We're human beings in our daily lives somehow fragmenting bear populations over a large scale, for instance, 100,000 square kilometers from Jasper to the U.S. border and into British Columbia. It's a real big scale.
How did you travel that area?
A lot of ways, on foot, on horseback, and on helicopter. But I did a lot of the field work myself where I collected these genetic samples from wild bears around much of the landscape, but also there's many other grizzly bear projects going on in the region. So I would take their genetic samples from those. For instance, the far reaches like Jasper in that area, Foothills Model Forest Project, they gave me their grizzly bear samples. And mostly in southern and southeastern BC is where I did most of my field work. Car, foot, and helicopter.
When you say genetic samples, what do you mean by that?
We were looking for just a piece of living tissue from the bear, and the simplest way we could find to get that was to lure a bear into a smelly corral made out of barbed wire, and we would get a wad of hair off the bear, and that was usually accompanied by a little tissue in the follicle of the hair, and that was a source of DNA, and we'd use that for commonly referred term DNA fingerprinting, where we can use the specific genetic markers to individually identify bears.
How many bears did you end up dealing with then?
You know, I had around about 1,000 bears. That was a lot of bears to deal with, a lot of numbers to deal with. Every bear genotype has 30 numbers to it, so my work was centered really around 30,000 numbers.
So would you say that's pretty well covers the population, or is it just a percentage of it?
That's a percentage. Actually, it's a good percentage because in the areas where we worked, we sampled roughly about half the bears who live there, but we didn't sample everywhere. So we're somewhere under 50% of the bears in southwestern Alberta and southeastern BC. It's hard to say how many bears are out there, maybe 3,000-4,000 or something, but I had about 1,000 of them, which represented a good sample size. Pretty hard in large carnivore work to get that many animals in your computer.
What did you find out with this 1,000 bears that you're dealing with?
Basically found that the populations were being fragmented at varying levels. They were being fragmented by linear human development. That would be the roads and then associated human settlement that is associated with the road. When I say fragmentation, what I mean is that that's limiting the movement of bears through the human environment. For instance, Highway 1 west out of Calgary, a lot of traffic on that highway, and it's limiting some types of bears across that highway. And that was mostly a traffic effect, but we also found areas where there was lots of human settlement, some places in southern British Columbia where there's almost continuous human settlement over just a very thin area, maybe 2 kilometers, would completely eliminate the movement of males and female bears and create the isolated populations.
Well, if we weren't here and the roads weren't here, how would the bears react then? Would they travel much further? How far would they go? What would be normal for them, minus the human element?
Yeah, something we call in biology the panmictic population. That is, everybody's having sex with everybody over the space. Bears move around a lot. Sometimes their home ranges can be up to several thousand square kilometers. I do have some parts of my study area where I used as controls, which were not fragmented, and you could see the bear mixing, for instance, across the continental divide between Alberta and British Columbia. South of Highway 3, there's a complete mixing of bears. The bears are interbreeding between British Columbia and Alberta very thoroughly. It just looks like one population. Now, as soon as you look at that same area across Highway 3 from like Blairmore through to Fernie and Elko, then you see the beginnings of a genetic separation across that highway, basically because a portion of the animals that used to move across there are not moving across. And when I say they're not moving, they actually are still moving. Mostly they end up getting killed in the process. Bears move across the landscape kind of slowly. As an offspring moves away from its mother, it doesn't just get up and move at age 3 and move 200 kilometers. It actually moves out just a small distance, maybe half a home range diameter away. So as bears move across a landscape through time and through generations, it's very slow, and it's a very slow movement. So bears have to live in areas that they move through, if that makes any sense. And that's what makes it difficult for bears to move through a human environment, because they got to live there. And then they end up getting attracted to dog food or chickens or apples, and often they get killed. So it's a combination of a little bit of avoidance and a little bit of a higher mortality risk living in and around humans.
Is it really that bad for them, though, being isolated or fragmented that way?
You know, population and habitat fragmentation is ubiquitous in the world. That's what creates species, and that's what drives evolution, is the limits to movement. So it is a very natural phenomena. And I have some evidence of natural fragmentation in my study area. Where it becomes a problem, so it is when the resulting populations that are being fragmented are severely fragmented and small. Small isolated populations are an elevated conservation risk, and usually require some extra management to make them not go extinct or to be extirpated. And I ended up at the bottom end of the distribution of bears in North America along the U.S. border. We found a few populations that were completely isolated, and there's one is under 100 animals, and it's an elevated conservation risk that requires some management. It's not an immediate threat of disappearing, but over the long haul, several hundred years or even less, it could potentially disappear. Animals need to be connected to a large base of other animals within that species. They need to be all kind of linked together for a variety of reasons. But
what else did you find out?
A couple of interesting things. One was that we also wanted to besides understanding how they were fragmented, we wanted to try to estimate how far do they typically move from their parents. Like how far does a male move from its mom, and how far does a female move from its mom? And bears are pretty solitary, so they don't live in family units. The father is he's long gone by the time the offspring are born, or at least he's back in his own home range, not interacting with the kids. So it's been hypothesized. There's been a little bit of work on bear dispersal that shows that they disperse quite a far distance. And what we interestingly found out in southern Canada, that they don't disperse very far, and we're not exactly sure why, maybe because of the difficult topography, but the females disperse away from their mother on average maybe 10 to 15 kilometers, center of home range of mother to center of home range to the offspring after it's moved. And the males maybe just move 40 or 50 kilometers on average. So some will move farther and some will move less. But that was pretty interesting and a little bit unexpected. We had some indications from some previous work that that might be the case, but we had a big sample size. We had over 100 individuals that had moved away from their parents. So
what did these sorts of things mean for management then of grizzly bears? Is that something you're looking at?
Yeah, I'm one of the research I'm doing now is to try to understand how bears behave and live around those human environments, and what we might do to facilitate their movement back and forth. And of course, popular in Alberta is the highway crossing structures on Highway 1. Well, that's within a park where there's not many people living there. But how does that work in the multiple-use landscape of where people live and work? So we're radio-collaring bears to try to find out. In some instances, the males are still moving across the highways. It's the females who have been mostly inhibited from moving. So these remnant male movers are becoming very useful. We put a radio collar on it, and we're trying to find out what characteristics on the landscape do bears like to use for moving through human environments. And we're using that to try to build some predictive linkage models where bears move, and then we're going to take that to the managers, which to this point have been very receptive. The managers in British Columbia and where I work mostly are sort of poised, waiting for the data so they can actually go out and implement some of these management strategies we come up with. And we're getting some good luck so far.
You had mentioned something about gene separation, that you're noticing that in these fragmented areas. What does that mean for the bears?
Generally, biologically, it's if you're an isolated population, you're small, you suffer what we call genetic drift, and the end result of that is you have a loss of genetic diversity, and that's typically thought of as being kind of a negative force on a population. With bears, there's one population that I have that's lost 20% of its heterozygosity or its genetic diversity, and that's a red flag for a problem. The truth is, while that is a potential problem, genetic problems work over hundreds of years. They'll reduce reproductive capacity often over it's a long time scale problem. But 85-95% of all bears die at the hands of humans one way or another, if either legal hunting in British Columbia or problem wildlife. And the human caused mortality is a faster acting force on grizzly bear populations. So while the genetics is a long-term problem, the fragmentation really needs to be dealt with at an individual bear level, because we need to keep females moving back and forth across populations. So while genetics is important, it really takes a second seat to just human-caused mortality on bear populations.
When we were talking before, you kept saying that this was fun for you and that you found out lots of fun things. What's so fun about chasing after grizzly bears?
I'm happiest out in the middle of nowhere, walking up down a mountain slope. And it takes you to very, very interesting habitats, and it definitely keeps your senses awake while you're out there working. Ran into a bear this season. The radio collar was supposed to have fallen off, but when I found the radio collar, it was still on the bear. So it keeps you quite awake and agile moving away. But mainly just the outdoors. But the really cool thing on top of that is finding out a pattern in ecology in that big, open, wide world out there. You get in a helicopter and the world just looks huge. To go out and to collect your samples and find a pattern in the ecology is very fascinating, and that's what sort of hooked me on this whole science routine.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
That was biologist Dr. Michael Proctor. He's a postdoctoral fellow working with Dr. Mark Boyce, who holds the Alberta Conservation Association Research Chair in Wildlife and Fisheries at the University of Alberta. That wonderful original tune is called Witchin' for Water. It's from the latest CD by the Swifties. Well, wherever there's a scientific gathering, you're bound to find poster displays and poster competitions. Distilling their experiments and findings into a few key points on a poster is one of the most important ways researchers communicate their work. And the poster competition at the recent Alberta Conservation Association's conference in Calgary was no exception. And while I was there, I had a chance to talk to some of the young scientists on hand to discuss their work.
Yeah, hello. My name is Nathan Varley, and I am a graduate student, a PhD student at the University of Alberta. And I am studying the recovery of wolves throughout the Rocky Mountains, and in particular a few case study areas in Banff National Park and Yellowstone National Park. What's happening is wolves are recovering in areas where they've been absent for some time. And in those areas, typically their prey, which are often elk or other herbivores, elk or deer, have come to some great abundance and have suppressed some of the vegetation species that they eat in those areas. What our research is showing and what we're seeing is that when wolves begin to recover, some of the vegetation starts to be released in the sense that it begins to grow like it hasn't for, say, decades. In the case of Yellowstone Park, wolves have been gone for 70 years, and the willow and aspen there haven't gotten above knee-high in about that long.
And why is that?
Mainly, it's the elk have grown to these large abundances. They've become very dense on their winter range, and they eat it all, essentially, is what's going on. And we're trying to get at the exact mechanisms of why we're starting to see some tall willow and aspen in some of these areas. And it's looking like it's linked to wolves, certainly, and it may not just be the wolves coming in and eating some of the elk so that there's fewer of them, but more of a response by the elk to the fact that now there's a predator out there that's out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they have to be a little bit more careful about where they live and where they eat. And so while they still eat some of these things like willow and aspen, it's not as often or it's not as much, and it's allowing some of these plants to regenerate in these areas. So it's a predation risk response that we're trying to get at and describe more specifically. It's elk that are worried about being killed by by a wolf, and they're trying to minimize that chance of being killed by a wolf.
So is that a good thing?
I think it's a good thing in natural areas, in places like national parks, where they're generally trying to manage for ecological process. Actually having a predator-prey relationship back in those areas restores a certain integrity to the ecosystem, and that's what a top predator can do. It can affect the species below it in a trickle-down or a trophic cascade kind of sense. And I do think that's generally what we're managing for in those natural areas. And so in that regard, I do think it's a good thing.
Are there any other benefits?
There are, in fact, that in some of those communities where we're starting to see the growth return in willow and aspen, it will invite some of the species that use those back into the areas. Songbirds, even beavers will come back in and start using them, and then further changes can happen, especially in the case of the beaver. It can really start changing the entire appearance of that habitat. And in a sense, we think that is more of a restored or a high integrity type of site after that has occurred there.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm Cameron Aldridge from the University of Alberta.
What question are you researching here with your poster?
I'm trying to address some of the more pertinent issues dealing with sage-grouse population declines in the province. From an ultimate perspective, what I'm trying to do is develop management guidelines that allow managers to actually manage the habitat appropriately to ensure that we have long-term viable populations of sage-grouse within the province.
Why sage-grouse and not something else? What's the significance of sage-grouse to the ecosystem?
Well, I think that sage-grouse are a good indicator of the overall health of the prairie ecosystem. And there's a lot of other sagebrush obligates out there, and they all depend on sagebrush and the native shrub steppe habitat. And if we can maintain and manage habitat for sage-grouse, we're sure to ensure that many other species will persist in that habitat as well.
Now, your poster here at the ACA conference outlines some of the things that you found out. What are you trying to portray in this poster?
Well, what I'm trying to do is build models that allow us to understand habitat requirements for sage grouse. Not just where are they and where do they occur and what they use, but also what are they successful at using and in doing so. And in understanding those, it allows me to build thresholds in terms of both the habitat and in terms of the industrial human use on the landscape. And we can understand what those thresholds are and provide those to managers so that they can adequately manage to ensure that not only is there enough suitable habitat out there for sage grouse to use, but they will survive and be successful in reproducing and doing so.
Can you give me a specific example?
Some of the ideas I'm just working on right now for my dissertation deal with managing suitable sagebrush habitat, minimum threshold needs. We found things such as nesting success is completely driven by the residual grass cover and structure surrounding those nests. If we can maintain suitable amounts of cover out there from a management and range perspective, as well as maintaining suitable canopy of sagebrush, we can ensure that nests are successful. The other things I'm looking at and just involved in right now is assessing the impacts of some of the fragmentation and human changes on the landscape. While sage grouse may use areas that are in proximity or in high quality habitat from the perspective of the vegetation, they might be in close proximity to some of these human resources. And does that pose additional survival risks?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My name is Kalina Noel. I'm from the University of Calgary and I'm a graduate student there.
What is your poster about? I see you're talking about elk and ungulates.
Yes, I'm looking at ungulates, actually elk in particular, in the Amdia foothills just south of Calgary. And the reason I chose that area is that there's a lot more development that's being dealt with down there with the expansion of the 22X and that type of thing. We're looking at a lot more country residential development. And elk are a good species to choose because they are most affected by change, land use change, habitat fragmentation, that type of thing. They live in large groups, and so they're most affected by smaller, you know, land use type things and that. So what I did is I went out into the field and I was looking for presence of elk pellets. Not glamorous, but it's cheap and it's just as strong a scientific method to use. And from there I'm looking at other land use practices, features such as terrain, elevation, that type of thing. And what I'll end up with is a prediction surface for where elk could be or where, and where they are presently. For the MDF foothills to make decisions on best areas for land use development.
What kinds of things might come out of this?
I'm hoping that the MD will have a nice strong tool to use to make land use decisions. I think there's going to be a lot more people coming in with propositions for development. I think this way they'll have a stronger scientific tool to make better decisions for where development should go in and not that it shouldn't go in.
Have you found out anything really surprising or interesting?
Well, definitely what you just said about elk. They are being seen more, but I think people are seeing them in pockets. And so what's happening is if habitat is being reduced, that you'll see them more squashed up. And so you think you're seeing them more often than you are, but you're not really. Elk are quite migratory, and they like to move around, especially during the wintertime, finding food. And so definitely that's an issue. So,
how did you find it, putting your poster together?
Oh, it's been a great experience. I mean, that's what university's for. I think anybody who's in university, you learn amazing skills, even if you... It doesn't matter what discipline you come out with. So,
well, good luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
I'm Lee Foote. I'm an associate professor at the Department of Renewable Resources and on the board of directors of the Alberta Conservation Association. For today, I've been tapped to be a judge for the poster competition.
What do you do as a judge? What are you looking for with these posters?
Mostly it's how well someone can convey information. Posters have got to get their message across very quickly, 2 or 3 minutes from a distance of 2 meters away. So it's got to grab my attention. It's got to inform me quickly. The person attending the poster has got to engage me, tell me something about it, let me walk away a bit educated. But for the theme of this conference, partnerships are really critical. So if it has a partnership component, that's really important as well.
Why are posters so important at these scientific conferences?
Several reasons. From the selfish perspective, it gives aspiring students or young professionals a chance to network and possibly gain employment. Also to practice their spiel, their ability to communicate to the scientific community and to the broader public. It's you have a captive audience here when you have the author of the poster, the data in front of you, and their conclusions. And so a stranger walking by can stop and say, Gee, that's really interesting. How did you come to this conclusion? You can challenge them. It's direct one-on-one interaction that you rarely get in a presentation or even in radio or TV.
You're not alone on this judging panel. What are your other judges? How are you going to get together and come to a conclusion?
We're going to battle it out. We made an executive decision early on to judge on our own criteria. Then we'll get together and talk and argue and debate and try to upgrade or downgrade various posters. It'll be a little bit of a cat fight, but we have a nice objective ranking scheme with 6 major points, 5 different categories. So we'll build a matrix, and the top score wins.
Anything standing out for you so far?
The entire level of poster making these days. Maybe it's a technological improvement, but the plotters are great, the graphics are incredible, the overlays, the colors, the richness, the font sizes are really good. The digital images, it's kind of overwhelming, really. I'm of an age where we had old tape and Velcro and spray-on stick-em and pretty dinosaurish stuff. This is really high-tech.
Well, I'm anxious to see who wins. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. And Cheryl, I'll give you a shameless plug. These little sound bits you're doing are really a great way of informing the public in sound bits, very much like a poster.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Sure. Bye.
That was Dr. Lee Foote, an assistant professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. He's on the board of directors for the Alberta Conservation Association, and he was one of 3 judges of the poster competition. And before that, I also spoke with Nathan Varley, Cameron Aldridge, and Kalina Noel, participants at the recent ACA conference and poster session in Calgary. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the University of Lethbridge, Science Alberta Foundation, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.